Welcome to Uncommons. I'm Nate Erskine-Smith, and on this episode, I am joined by one of the two Green Party MPs in the House of Commons. I'm joined by Mike Morris for Kitchener Centre. He has been elected since 2021. He ran in the 2019 election as well and started to really build a base. He is incredibly thoughtful. I have enjoyed working with him on many things, including the Canada Disability Benefit, advocacy to push it to get it to where it is and hopefully push it beyond where it is now. We get into the details of that. He's got real criticisms that I think the government should heed. We've also worked together on issues of excess profits, and we share a lot in common. Share a lot in common, too, around the goals we have as MPs for delivering for our local constituencies and not just being overly partisan all of the time. And so I hope you enjoy the conversation that is focused on the disability benefit, on climate action, and especially on how we improve our democracy. It is Earth Day and we have a green MP on the podcast. That seems right.
Well done to you and your team.
Okay, so speaking of which, though, I there are lots of things that I want to get to, including this budget and the disability benefit, including some of the politics in the Green Party. But first, for those who don't know you, you're elected for the first time in 2021. You fought an election in 2019. You had a cancer diagnosis along the way, and you've been long active in environmental politics or environmental activism, maybe in the Waterloo region. Walk us through what brought you to politics.
Well, I never expected to run, first of all. I got, after university, started a nonprofit looking to get businesses to do more on the climate crisis, spent 10 years of doing that. And I think the best analogy I've got now would be, I felt like we were shoveling snow and making a little progress. And then the snowplow came by and undid the work we were doing. And that was buying the TMX pipeline in 2018. It was a few days after that Parliament had affirmed we were in fact in a climate emergency, and that hit me hard, along with other big challenges that we're facing, housing and poverty among them, that it just felt pretty existential, which I think was important for me because, as you mentioned, things did get hard. The cancer diagnosis was in 2019. It was in the midst of that campaign in August of that year. And like no BS, it's the reason why I pushed through is it felt to me so deeply existential. I had this sense of, what's the point of anything if we're not going to have a safe, livable future for our kids? And so whether it was, five doors in a row in the pouring rain, no one's home, I can't even write not home on my sheet, or it's the diagnosis, there wasn't even a question of like, would I pause the campaign? It was so obvious that we would push through it. And I'm of course so fortunate. It was stage one. The surgery was a week after the campaign in late October of 2019. I never saw myself and like I never expected to run. It was never part of my life plan or anything like that. And now I feel so kind of wired for it. And I think it's a privilege if any of us get to do the thing that we feel most lit up by and, wired to do.
Yeah, I will miss it a great deal. I am convinced and I've encouraged others to think the same way that this is the way to make the biggest difference.
Well, and of course, there are a lot of other ways to push. We need strong activism outside of Parliament as well. But certainly if I look at what you've done over the years, and if I think about my day-to-day and the diversity of influence when it comes to whether it's helping somebody with a permanent residency application or to reunite with a spouse through our constituency office, or if it's fighting to end poverty for folks with disabilities, I'm not sure there's anything else I could be doing with my time that's going to have a larger impact than this, which helps me push through the days where it just feels like partisan noise and realize that my job is to kind of find my way through everything I kind of hate about it, because I know that there's so much good in it too.
Yeah, and find the opportunities in it to push the boulder up the hill, because and let's pick up on the disability benefit, because there have been certain moments in time, and in some cases you and I have come together on it, where one, it was to get the government to act on poverty reduction. This is before your time, but earlier on, I was focused on the Canada Workers Benefit, and we delivered, I would say, not a sizable sum, but it has grown over the years into a more sizable sum. Still nowhere close to what the Canada Child Benefit is, or GIS for Seniors, or OAS, but still, it's increased incrementally over the years. The disability benefit remained a missing piece. The government promises it in the course of a throne speech and a platform. And then we have this promise of legislation, but then the legislation stalls. And you find a moment in time, myself and others within the Liberal caucus, but you publicly, and I was at a press conference with you, to say, let's expedite this process. And that was one moment in time. And then another moment in time, and feel free to comment how you like, but the next moment in time is, okay, great, we've got legislation, but it's nothing without dollars and cents in a budget. So now here's a moment in time to push forward. What has it looked like from your perspective, this slog it probably feels like in some ways, yeah. But you're engaging with the disability community or disability communities in some ways on the outside, and internally you're fighting the fight with the minister, and then publicly you're at press conference and otherwise calling for action.
Well, I think, first of all, going back to soon after I was elected, we had that petition going from the disability community.
Yes, right.
And that's when, you know, you jumped in, not only to join for that press conference, but to mobilize others within your party. For me, that was a really critical moment. That was back early 2022, and we had, I think it was 70-some-odd MPs from the Liberal, Conservative, Bloc, and Green parties. The NDP believed in the same words but wanted to have their own letter, so they had their own. What it mattered, though, in terms of the pressure, is we were able to make clear that parliamentarians on all sides wanted to see this thing move ahead. And, you know, we did that in February 2022. The Senate had their version of it, and it meant that the bill came forward in June. And for me, that was a moment of seeing, okay, this is how we can, in fact, work together.
How you mobilize. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but folks like yourself went inside of their own parties to then build that support and bring people together. So I think it helped move the legislation along. Of course, I'm deeply disappointed, as I think you know already.
We had brief words when we were when we were passing. I was on my way out. You were on your way into Parliament.
Pretty sure this is your first episode though post budget, and we're talking about the disability benefit as that first episode. So I think that's fantastic. It is not what was promised in the throne speech or in the 2021 election campaign.
Yeah, so let's be clear. So walk the listeners who have not followed. The minutiae of the disability benefit advocacy, as so many people have who are going to be affected by it. But for those who haven't focused on this in quite the same way, what was the promise and what have we come to?
Well, and the big picture starts with the fact that 40% of folks living in poverty across the country are folks with disabilities. So if you're a person who cares about reducing poverty, you should be someone who's looking at improving the quality of life and ending legislative poverty for folks with disabilities. It's 1.5 million Canadians with disabilities who are living in poverty. As a result of the advocacy from the disability community, the first commitment was in the 2020 throne speech. It was then reiterated in the 2021 election. There was a bill just beforehand that had put the kind of broad contours of it. In that platform commitment, it was talking about using or implementing a Canada Disability Benefit to reduce poverty, similar to had been done with the Guaranteed Income Supplement and the Canada Child Benefit. And that benefit, of course, now is meant to be a supplement. So we have provincial programs and territorial programs in place across the country. For us in Ontario, that's the Ontario Disability Support Program. It's recently been increased by 6.5% and still is a measly $1,308. The shelter allowance, I think, is $556. You can't find an apartment in Kitchener for that amount of money. I doubt it's the case in Beaches East York either.
Certainly not, yeah.
And so the idea was meant to be to provide a benefit that would stack on top of those existing provincial and territorial supports to lift a person above the poverty line. In terms of what was committed and what we've seen come through, I think that's where there's obviously more work to be done to put more pressure to say this is not where we need to be.
And as I said to you, so I would share your disappointment insofar as I think when you look at the social safety net architecture of this country, and as someone who believes in a basic income and a social safety net that leaves nobody behind, I mean, I take the point of the BC basic income panel that says no to a basic income, but really they argue for a different kind of basic income support, which is one for working low-income working Canadians and another for people with disabilities. And there you do start to have the makings of a more comprehensive social safety net. So it's all about, I think, having the benefit in place really does matter. The design of it obviously matters too, but the quantum is one thing that I think will increase over time. Now, Disability Without Poverty rightly says too little for too few. I think that's a fair criticism. I did say to you on the way into the house, though, I said this to Pam DeMoff because she was leading the charge in the lead up to this budget on the Liberal side, really calling for us to fund it in a serious way. When Daily Bread Food Bank was calling for like a $10 to $12 billion spend annually, I thought there's no way that's going to happen. Where's the money going to come from? When we see $6.1 billion over 6 years and then $1.4 annually, that is the single largest line item. Now, budget, you know, defense is larger when you aggregate all the defense items together by you know, $2 or so billion, but it's still a significant spend. So I guess the question I have, I mean, how, if we're going to do a $10 billion annual benefit, let's say that's what our goal is, where are we, how are we going to pay for it? And where should we direct our, you know, my energies and your energies? I think part of the advocacy has to be, we want it fully funded and this is the way forward.
Yep. Well, it's the right question to be asking. Budgets are about priorities and we need to show that there is revenue to pay for it. One of the examples I've been putting forward in recent days is the windfall profit tax on the excess profits of the oil and gas industry. If we were to move forward with even a 15% tax on profits over $1 billion, which is exactly what happened with banks and life insurance companies in the pandemic, that would generate $4.2 billion a year. If you think it takes $1.1 billion, as you just shared earlier, to lift 600,000 people with an extra $200, $4.2 billion would support that same number of people with another 800. So now you're talking about an extra 1,000 a month in Ontario. That would take the 1,300, move it to 2,300. Now you're above the poverty line. The other issue, of course, is that what's being proposed is being proposed to deliver the disability benefit through the disability tax credit, which we can talk about separately, but that's why that number is smaller. We actually need it delivered to more people. So to be fulsome in answering your question, we're going to need more than that. The other place I would point to is the subsidies to carbon capture. There's $5.7 billion more in new subsidies to a completely unproven technology. If you take that same $5.7 billion, well, now that actually allows us to move us to double the number of people eligible. So now you're 1.2 million people at 1,000 each. And that's, you know, money we're giving an industry that made $38 billion on their own after share repurchases and dividends and everything else. That's separate from the $18 billion in subsidies to oil and gas. And so if you're going to have a serious conversation about where money needs to come from, we need to be talking about the money we're throwing at the oil and gas industry in the midst of a climate crisis. And I think if you look at the words, to me, it's about expectations. The expectations that were set, generational benefit, former Minister Carla Quattro, on this podcast, what was the words that Minister Quattro had shared? Let me pull it up.
Someone's listening to the podcast. We have at least one
listener. Oh, yeah. You got
to do only to do your homework, though.
Of course. Shoot, I can't find it now. Here it is. The sleeper legacy piece, if we do it right. And I think that it could have been a legacy. And for all the
I think
talk,
should have been. In a way, when you think of, you say budgets rightly are about priorities. And no one was going to dismantle this. I can imagine Pierre Poilievre gets elected in the next election if he does, and he's going to cut dental care. I have no doubt that $4.4 billion a year is going to disappear. I have no doubt he's going to cancel the nascent pharmacare, $1.5 billion over 5 years. And so right there, he's got $5 billion a year to swipe off the table. I can't imagine he's going to cut the disability benefit. He already kind of looks like a ghoul sometimes when he talks about you know, cutting this and cutting that. I can't imagine he's going to want to look like a ghoul and cut a benefit for disabilities. And this would have been a benefit. We would wake up 20, 30 years from now and say, we did that, and it stood the test of time, like guaranteed income supplement, like the Canada Child Benefit. And I think instead we're in a place, and I said this when I was commenting in the wake of the budget, we're now in a place where, you know, I think ahead, fair to have a conversation where we're critical of a decision, but I think when I think of my own advocacy, what's next? Well, now I need to redouble my efforts and alongside colleagues to ensure that funding improves in keeping with our economic situation. I can understand why, you know, they weren't able to break the bank and fund it to such a degree given the difficult economic circumstances and the Bank of Canada breathing down their neck, but we now have to redouble our efforts to make sure that this is a priority in future budgets.
Well, it's an important point, Nate, right? For those of us who believe in a guaranteed income, and I'm with you in that, to everything I think you've done in your time as an MP, when it's focused on actually being constructive to get something that can get cross-party support, folks might be surprised to know that all parties supported moving the legislation, the underpinning framework legislation for the benefit, that had unanimous consent to move ahead with. And we even had some conservative MPs, as I mentioned earlier, Marilyn Gladue, who's been on your show before. She was one of the folks that signed on, Scott Aitchison as another. And so I think you're right. It's an example of something that once it's in place, far more difficult to take it back. And maybe that makes it just that much more important for us to collectively, we've got probably another year and a half before the next election. When I talk to NDP colleagues, I think, okay, what can you push for in exchange for your support in this budget? I've been putting forward to them on the floor of the House and in private conversations that this could be something that they push for in exchange for their support. And there's a full economic statement. There's another budget to follow. Yeah. There's more work we need to continue to do. We can't say that this is it. I've heard the talking point about it being the largest. Let's be clear, though. It's the largest new investment. It's not the largest
single
investment.
Yeah, that's right. It's the largest. It's the largest line item of new investment in this budget as far as it goes. But in fairness, defense comes in at $8 billion over five if you aggregate everything together.
Per year. Yeah. And when we compare it against, again, I think for the disability community, that throne speech said, like GIS, like Canada Child Benefit. Well, yeah. GIS is $15 billion a year. The Canada Child Benefit is $24 billion. So there was an expectation set that we were speaking in that generational type of investment. And so I think that creates the space for you and I and others from all parties who believe in a benefit that would end poverty for folks with disabilities to constructively work towards getting it higher, if only for also in keeping trust in government.
Yeah,
like these are the kinds of things where people say, "Well, what's the point of that promise at all?"
Whereas, it's an interesting thing. It was such a fight to get it to where it's been or where it is now, I should say. But that isn't to say the fight's over. I do think, thinking back to the Canada Child Benefit, it's interesting. Sherry Torjman and Ken Battle, they're social policy researchers. I know Sherry a bit better. She's joined me locally for an event, and when they designed the Canada Child Benefit for the Caledon Institute before it was called the Canada Child Benefit. Right. And then the Liberal Party came along and they plucked it out from the Caledon Institute and made it a central part of the 2015 tax fairness platform and away we go, or fairness platform, I should say, and away we go. It was largely designed in a way, I mean, there was a top up, right? So there was a $4 billion top up, $2 billion of which came from canceling income splitting, and $2 billion was new, and then the rest of it was consolidating a series of benefits, including benefits that were poorly targeted. And so I do think when we think about the next phase of advocacy, and we want to put more meat on the bone and change the distribution, it can't be through the DTC, but two, and so you're looking at a wider pool of recipients, but two, when you're looking at increasing the overall quantum of the benefit as an expenditure on behalf of the government, I think we do have to be pretty laser focused on saying, and here are ways, here are other this is where we can, some new money maybe, but here's other ways we can better spend money targeted toward people with disabilities. Economist Chris Reagan criticized the budget, but then he said, no, the disability benefit is something that was worth to support. It's like, okay, great, well, let's all lean into that then.
But that's actually the core issue, I think, Nate. is my concern is the way it's designed is actually for non-disabled people to think that the government is doing more than they are. Because I haven't heard a single person with a disability or organization that serves folks with disabilities who've said that this is what they were looking for.
No, so, well, on the DTC side, 100%, the design is lackluster and missing, and,
well,
and the exact opposite of what they asked for, actually.
Well, and it's actually in contravention of an amendment I got passed.
Interesting.
One of the amendments we got through required the benefit to be barrier-free. So as you know, like, the bill is framework. Section 11 leaves almost everything to regulations. So tried to get amendments passed that said when you do the regulations, it must be such and such. It must be indexed to inflation, for example. But one of them we got passed said that the benefit must be delivered barrier-free. And so when I first started to hear the rumors of the DTC being used back in December, I got up in QP to ask about it, followed up in February. I don't think anyone can make an argument that the DTC is barrier-free. I do appreciate, I'll give credit, there is money set aside to help pay for the doctors who are going to have to be filling out all these forms. But in my view, that's actually in contravention of the act. And
well,
I believe...
And the right way to do it, just because you're talking about forms, I mean, with the right agreements with the provinces and territories, there's already a disability welfare system in place, and we should be piggybacking on that and ensuring that this is a supplement on top of that, which is really how it was envisioned.
Well, and I think... To your points, Nate, I've heard you make on this podcast so many times before, is you've advocated for serious legislation. In my view, what they've put forward is just unserious. And we know examples. So using childcare as an example, I think the government was serious about childcare. So they put a serious amount of money forward to begin with. They then negotiated and they locked it in with C-35 as legislation on the tail end.
Yeah.
And so to me, if you're serious about it, that's the right approach to have taken. Whereas here, we're kind of seeing it happen reverse. You see framework legislation being put forward first. Then we hear talk of consultation with provinces and with the disability community. But then the budgeted amount is nowhere near what folks had been actually calling for. So for all the talk, we've been hearing for 3 years now about...
Yeah.
Well, don't rush it. We got to do it right. We got to consult. I just don't see how from that consultation, there's no agreements in place yet. I haven't seen any at least. And one of the amendments actually required that those agreements be shared when they are in place. So for 3 years, you didn't get agreements with provinces and territories. You didn't put forward something that is what the disability community called for. And so I'm looking at folks like yourself and Pam and others, because I know that you're one of the folks in the governing party that is pushing for more. So to me, it's about how do we now push for something that is more serious?
Yeah, and I think the two areas, I mean, the delivery through DTC is one area that is I think a real conversation can still be had. I think the larger item, which is to get back to dollars and cents, I mean, why is this less than what the disability community wanted? It's because of the financial headwinds, the economic headwinds. And already in this budget as it is, despite a new tax to pay for new spending, people are calling for defense spending. Okay, there's defense spending. People are calling for this disability benefit to be realized. It's realized in a smaller measure than people wanted. But when you look at all these new priorities that are put on the table with new spending, it's paid for in part by this new capital gains tax, but partly through some modest deficit financing. And there's not a lot of fiscal room beyond beyond that. And so it's why I would return to it. And I think let's talk excess tax, profits tax a little bit more, because I don't think that is the right answer for a benefit like this. I think the way you had proposed it in your motion, where you tie a short-term tax, an excess profits tax is not to be a forever tax. It's to say there are windfall gains in a particular moment in time, and we're going to tackle that. Use those windfall gains, which are one-time or short-term gains, temporary gains, use those to fund programs that are one-time investments, like the Greener Homes Grant. I don't think you can seriously bank on that for an ongoing forever benefit. But I did like your motion, which tied the windfall tax on oil and gas to greener homes, for example. It was, tax gains for oil and gas companies in a time where we need them to do more. And if they're not going to do more, we're going to put those proceeds into homeowners' hands or property owners' hands to retrofit and improve the efficiency of their homes. It seems like a good idea.
Yeah. I hear you on that. I guess where I would push back is the expectation was actually set in the throne speech and in the election platform. And so I don't think it's totally fair to say it's not what the disability community wanted. It's actually not even what the party that got elected said they were going to do. So then, but then the converse is, you're right, where can the money come from? Nobody asked that when we bought the TMX pipeline. And, you know, we found $35 billion somehow for that. We're finding new money for these tax credits for oil and gas still. And so I think...
But not forever expenditures, right? Like, look, I'm not going to defend TMX. TMX is a disaster, and it's a, you know, some money will come back, but they're never going to recoup the investment, if you want to call it an investment. Yeah. But you're never going to recoup that. The tax credits, I think, you know, we can debate the merits of carbon capture and, you know, whether it should be part of the picture. It's obviously not the predominant part of any climate plan, or shouldn't be. But even if you were to axe that, you're not looking at funding a $10 billion annual benefit. So I do think we have to look at, you know, I think the capital gains taxation is a really interesting way to proceed. There are other ways to go after wealth taxes. I think you could have looked at a capital gains tax plus inheritance taxation on ultra wealthy estates. And you said any money we're going to get from this is going to go directly into the disability benefit. And it would have been a pretty saleable pitch at that point. We're going to help the people in the greatest need by asking those who are wealthiest and best off to pay a little bit more. Instead, it's a bit disparate, right? It's like we are asking those to pay who are well off to pay a little bit more, but for what? And it's a series of different priorities, not just one major priority for those in need.
Yeah, I think it's a great point, because if you can make that direct connection, it's going to make it more difficult for those who inevitably... wealthiest folks have the largest platform. We're seeing this week some of the pushback that begins to emerge. If you talk about an inheritance tax, for example, if you talk about capital gains, which again is well below what the U.S. is already at as it is, there is more that could be done when it comes to wealth taxation. I take your point. We need to ensure that it's revenues on an ongoing basis. And if you were to tie it directly to a benefit like this, that has, you know, it's 89% of Canadians who believe we need to be doing better here.
Yeah, exactly.
And 22% of the population are folks with disabilities. I think you make it that much stronger of a case as opposed to what was presented last week, which is new revenue without tying specifically to what that does for Canadians. I think you're right from a communications point of view. It would be stronger if we were directly connecting those revenues to the programs that can be funded as a result, and then go to Canadians and say, is this the kind of country you want to live in? And in my view, we're a country that is wealthy enough that we shouldn't have folks with disabilities living in poverty, and we should find the funds to pay for it.
Similarly, we should be a country that's able to meet our obligations on the climate front. I want to... We agree. So disability benefit, I think there's a lot of agreement. There's, you know, I think you will be using your efforts over the coming years to make sure that's realized in an even more fulsome way. And I appreciate that. Greener homes, I think we're on the same page roughly. It was good to see at least that reprioritized in the budget. We'll see what the devil's in the details. We'll see what the details are on low and middle income homeowners and how it's going to help renters. The excess profits tax, I think we're on the same page. We probably share a lot of our politics is shared, I would say. When I look at your advocacy, I'm appreciative of it. You found your way to the Green Party. I found my way to the Liberal Party. Jenna Gatwin found her way to the Green Party and then to the Liberal Party. What do you see as the role of the Green Party today? You're one of two people in Parliament representing the Green Party. Your politics are not so different from some of us Liberals, not so different from some NDP members. I don't know what you make of, you know, Elizabeth May is obviously back as the leader, and there's a possible co-leadership role sometime down the road. How do you see, you know, before you get to your role, but how do you see the role that the Green Party plays? Is there still a role? Is there a point?
Why? Would say yes, it's the party I chose when I ran, and I didn't do it because it would be the easiest path towards getting elected. I think answering the question is tied to my own choice, which was trying to center my integrity and trying to think about how do I do this in a way where I don't become everything I hate about it. And I'd engaged with elected folks in my time in civil society and leading nonprofits, and I wanted to make sure that I could be fully honest, that I would always be putting, and of course, Greens have six values, but for me, it was, okay, these are my values, things like ecological wisdom, social justice, respect for diversity, participatory democracy. And within those values, I get to be thinking about my community first and foremost, as opposed to thinking about where's the win for my political party. And I think our democracy is better for that. I think I can, you know, advocate for my community with a higher fidelity, I guess. And that was, to me, the most important factor to center when I decided to run, even if I knew, you know, in a lot of ways, I say to folks, it was harder to get elected as a Green, but I feel like my job is easier as a Green. Like I don't have to rationalize to you, here's why I voted on such and such. It's part of what I respect about you, Nate, is I know that you've taken strong positions that have been different from the party. So I think the biggest difference in you and I isn't in the policies. It's how we've chosen to engage in our parliament to advocate for the things that I think if you went through the list, we'd agree on most of it.
Yeah, agree on most of it. Yeah, I think that's probably right.
And so then to get to your original question of like, what's the point of the Green Party? I guess it's something to be said for putting democracy ahead of the politics, that the interests of one's community should be front and center. And I know that that would be true. A lot of our colleagues would say that that's their aspiration. I believe I'm with a party that, you know, really has put that in the kind of core ethos.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that you. Yeah, yeah. I like that. It's interesting that you come back to sort of the how the party operates in terms of enabling that freedom to be an advocate for your community. It is one of the things that drew me actually to the Liberal Party under Trudeau. He was obviously calling for generational renewal, and that mattered a lot to me as a, I think, 29, 30 year old in the nomination. But it also really mattered to me, having been a student of political philosophy and have been a nerd about it, like the idea of less centralization, the idea of more grassroots politics, the idea of more bottom-up democracy, the idea of free votes in parliament, of open nominations, all of that mattered a great deal and was a central theme to his leadership. So it was, in some ways, speaks to the same, you know, one can, you know, electoral reform, we don't have to go down that rabbit hole necessarily. We would agree there too. But on the Democratic reform file, not always a win, but there have been, I think, wins where I feel the freedom to voice concerns. Now, obviously, there are still whipped votes at times, and you're not subject to those in quite the same way. But I think we would probably share that ethos to say we want strong local democracy to thrive.
I guess my question for you, Nate, is how do you feel like that's played out? If you think back to your 2014 self,
yeah,
if it was 2015 when you made the decision, and what you expected in terms of grassroots, and how do you feel that that's played out for you over your time as an MP?
Honestly, the greatest challenge at times has been navigating colleagues, not necessarily navigating the government, because you do feel when you speak out, there's an expectation that your colleagues then of similar ridings or, you know, geographic proximity, there's pressure on them where, you know, constituents will say, why aren't you doing this? Look at what your colleague's doing over there. And that can wear at you over time as someone, you know, I don't like to think of it always like a team sport, but there are, you know, you're in caucus every week together. There are relationships, there are personal relationships. So that can be difficult. The idea that there's always, I guess I never went in thinking I'm going to be a cabinet minister, like I'm playing to become something. I was pretty happy just to represent the community I grew up in. I probably should have had a longer term plan than that. I don't know. But it was a lot easier in some ways to go, okay, so I'm going to carve out this space for myself, and that's just what I'm going to do, and this is the role I'm going to play, and I'm comfortable with that. That's what I want to do. You said you've got a, what did you say? I don't want to become the thing that I hated or something. Like I was a big Kurt Vonnegut fan when I was growing up, and there's a line, you know, you are who you pretend to be, so be careful who you pretend to be. Mm-hmm. And it's guided my politics.
Do you feel, Nate, that someone who's taken the approach you've taken could be in cabinet? Or do you feel like that's been part, I've seen a few votes go down in our time where I think, okay, that person just voted against the party and now they're no longer chairing a committee or they're no longer in a parliamentary secretary role.
Yeah, I mean, I've never
you've been
had,
on the inside.
I've never had those. Right. No, I would say so. I will say I did confront early on. I confronted some challenges where there was an instance at the Public Safety Committee, for example, where I was very vocal. I was right in the end. I'm not always right, but I was right in the end on this, that the National Security Committee of Parliamentarians should have greater access to information, and I had an amendment to do just that. And we had a big blow up and things went sideways because Tony Clement can't read and everything else. But all that's to say that I had this moment where, you know, what are you doing on this committee? And I said, what am I doing on this committee? I've got this constitutional law background by studying at least. And if you don't want a civil liberties focus, then don't have me on this committee. And then I wasn't on the committee. And so there have been some of those more combative moments. But for the most part, I have tried to navigate myself in such a way that I say what I think. I do it in a respectful way. I could have burned down the house on electoral reform. It was, you know, the only time that I truly didn't feel like there was a home in that moment for me. But I didn't. And when I did public interviews, I said, you know, the prime minister's opinion is this on a referendum. Here's why I disagree. But I didn't make it personal. I didn't go to war in any way on a personal front, at least. And so I do think there's a way of navigating it. It's not always easy, but navigating in such a way that you still maintain influence in caucus and outside of caucus. Because I think what you do, and I think successfully, and what I try to do, sometimes successfully, you talked about, what would you say, diversity of influence? I really like the way you put it, that you've got influence on case files for sure. I've got influence on the government in different ways, sure. Relationships with ministers or relationships in the prime minister's office or building coalitions as we did with the Canada Disability Benefit. But then you've also got to think sometimes on some issues, you've got to change how people think about things outside of parliament before parliamentarians are going to act on it at all. And how do you go about making news to start to help to shape people's minds? And decriminalization and drug policy is, I've thought a lot about that. So you occupy that space, I think, successfully as a Green Party MP, where you're unconstrained by caucus colleagues in the same way, and you can say, I'm going to be vocal in the media and shape public opinion that way.
Well, yeah, thanks for that. I feel like I'm still learning. One of my stories early on, the leader of the party stepped down days after the election. And so while I was in orientation on the Hill, I had my first media call saying, are you going to think about running for leader? like, to use your team analogy.
I'm still trying to figure out where the bathroom is.
I'm a rookie and you're asking me to be captain of the team. This doesn't make any sense. So I'm 3 years
would have
in
made
now.
More sense than Annamie Paul, but yes.
Well, and I, you know, we needed to have the party needed to have that process for leadership renewal, and I'm really grateful that Elizabeth, she has the depth of experience to be able to speak on legislation when it comes to the Impact Assessment Act and Highway 413, for example. She lived through all that, and so she's been a real great resource to me in this advocacy. And I'm 3 years in, I feel like I'm still learning how to best, you know, you're still building movements the same way I used to when I was in nonprofit life before this. If you're doing it well, you're working alongside grassroots folks and the larger national organizations to build support for the changes you're looking to see.
And can I ask about that? Because you don't have the same challenges maybe I might have in navigating a big tent party and a caucus of 150 plus people. But you are a big tent party in a different way. You've got a very diverse membership. People come to the Green Party for different reasons. Some come for climate-related reasons. Some come because they're opposed to GMOs. Some come because of commitment to democratic values and pacifism, potentially. There are lots of different reasons someone might join the Green Party. And you saw you mentioned the stepping down of Annamie Paul, but that rift was over Israel-Palestine. And I don't know if Noah Zatzman's still a Green Party member. But
he's not.
I didn't think so. You do have, like, even in the pandemic, right, the wellness movement collided with the convoy movement in some ways. And so how have you had any challenges in navigating the big tent of membership, if not caucus?
I guess I see it as my job to be the best possible MP. And even if you're someone who cares about the Green Party first and foremost, and personally, I really do believe that my job is to be the best voice for Kitchener. But to me, if you're the best possible MP, other folks will say, I want some of that.
Yeah.
And it's kind of what we saw just happen. And we had a by-election, as you know, in Kitchener Center. And
yeah, you guys dominated.
Yeah, my good friend Ashlyn Clancy was elected with 48% of the vote. And that was as a result of her ability to connect with folks at doors. And I hope some of it might have been that folks in our community said, hey, you know, we've had a bit of what it's like to have a Green MP. I'd like to see more of that. And truthfully, in terms of my getting elected, you know, Mike Schreiner getting elected in Guelph in 2018.
Yeah, it mattered, yeah.
Folks here respect how Mike, not just what he's done, but how he's gone about it. I've sought to emulate that. I think it is possible to be, a strong, assertive voice while still being respectful. I'm trying to continue to navigate that effectively. And so truthfully answering your question is I don't see myself as kind of responsible for party membership across the country. I see myself as someone who is meant to be in Ottawa advocating for the interests of my community. And if I do that well, you're going to see more Greens elected because you'll see more communities looking at that and thinking, well, yeah, that is.
But maybe only
appealing.
Locally, right? It's interesting because I think you are bang on when you talk about the local races. I think there's no doubt that Schreiner's, the respect he has on the ground bled over to your race,
oh, for sure.
And that the respect you have on the ground bled over to the recent provincial win. And you'll have a lot of fun having the federal provincial counterparts working together in tight knit way. But I don't know that it bleeds over in the same way to Parry Sound Muskoka unless you have a more prominent regional or national presence as a Green Party. So I don't know.
Well, I would put to you that if you look at the kind of person that Mike Schreiner is, yeah. I did some door knocking in Parry Sound, Muskoka.
Oh, no, I say that because that was a close one.
Well, very much, right? That was in the last provincial election, the second strongest riding for Greens provincially. And again, it was a combination that Matt, who has run there, he's run there five times.
Holy.
You can't find someone who is like more obviously showing their commitment to serving their community.
Their stubbornness.
Well, a bit of both. If it is
existential
for you.
Nothing if
right?
not persistent. That's the job.
But you combine that with a leader who time and again shows that they're in it for the right reasons. They're in it for people. They're in it for a better democracy. I look at someone like Elizabeth and I see similar qualities there. So do I have, the plan for you of how Greens are going to grow from 2 to 20? I'm not saying I do, but in the role I'm in right now as a member of the caucus and a junior one at that, and someone who, I'm going to have to continue to work hard to be reelected. This is, I think a lot of folks in my community have taken a risk to vote Green for the first time and placing their trust in me. I need to continue to earn that trust. And my hope is by being, the best possible MP, when it relates to advocating on poverty or on housing, or we got to get two-way all day go built and we need a timeline on that, that I might have the chance to continue to do this work. And that if I do, I'll be able to demonstrate that, we can, for all the talk about doing politics differently, that you can do this with nuance, you can do it respectfully, and if you work hard enough, you get a chance to keep doing it. And I truly look at you, Nate, as someone who's shown that. You're going out on your own terms. If we all can be so lucky as to choose when we no longer serve in this capacity, I hope that if you look at Elizabeth's track record and the 3 years of mine, that would be the strongest proof point for why we need to see more Greens elected across the country.
And do you ever, so conversations with Jenica and conversations with, I'm sure I spoke to her a number of times throughout that process. It was a difficult time for her, for sure. But you've talked to her today. She seems quite happy to be able to make an even bigger impact. And if we're all out to make a bigger impact, and obviously there is this delicate balance in politics, you don't want to trade integrity for ostensible impact that may or may not come to fruition. And so I always thought it was a bit of a mug's game to play for cabinet and say things you didn't believe. Like, why would you ever want to do that? And so Janica seems, though, she's, you know, parliamentary secretary to Indigenous Services. It's a file she cares deeply about. She seems to be making a personal impact that is that matters a lot to her. Do you see that at all and say maybe there's something to that?
Well, I think it's about, again, as I shared earlier, between you and I, where our differences lie, maybe less in policy and more in how we believe what our priorities are and how we want to have the biggest difference.
Yeah, and everyone's got a role to play in some ways. And how are you going to make the biggest difference?
I was listening to Stephen Kiboa on Commons recently also, and I heard him say for him it was about implementation.
Yeah,
that he'd been an advocate for long enough, and his priority was getting to implement. Well, I saw him the day that Baie du Nord was approved. I can appreciate how difficult of a day that must have been for him. And, you know, he gets to be in a role right now in cabinet where he is implementing. I have chosen a different path. In fact, he and I both ran for the first time in 2019. We just chose different parties to run with.
Yeah.
I think what's different about Jenica's case is that she had such, to think of what she went through at a time when her own leader's office was saying things that were quite problematic.
Yeah, fair point.
Problematic.
It might not have happened before all of that.
But I respect her. To me, she's the kind of person that I can be alongside in advocating for a windfall profit tax, and I can be doing it from my vantage point. And I know she's doing it inside a caucus from hers. And if she is feeling well, healthy, and effective in that role, I respect her. It's not the choice I'm making. But not to say we can't work together.
No, and in the end, you know, as someone who is leaving Parliament at the end of this term, I mean, the more Mike Morrises and the more Jenica Atwins and the more Charlie Anguses and the more, frankly, Scott Aitchisons, I mean, there are people, even when I disagree with them, I mean, Scott really shouldn't show up in front of other people's offices to talk about the carbon tax in a silly way, but there are people who, on housing, for example, I would say he's brought to bear some advocacy that I think has been welcome in Canadian politics. But, you know, in the same way, you want hardworking, smart, thoughtful people even when you disagree with them, and more of them the better.
But here's the question for you, Nate, is that I look at someone like you and Charlie Angus as another, both of whom are leaving. Jody Wilson-Raybould would be another example. These are people of integrity who have made choices that they can have a larger impact outside of our parliament than in it.
And so I'm not making that choice.
So I want to hear that from you because I think
this is the best job I've ever had. I've made a huge difference in different ways, and I haven't won every battle, but I won a lot of them along the way. And even when I've lost, you know, sometimes you lose the battle, but you win the war. But I got a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, and if this job were in Toronto, if it were easier to manage the relentlessness that I want to bring to politics with the, you know, desire to be a good dad and a good husband, I'd be able to do it differently. My wife's doing her PhD. She's got multiple jobs on the side. She's as busy as anything. I need to be more present, I think, especially over the next, you know, number of years. And I wouldn't say I'm not coming back to it. Some people ask if it's the next provincial election. It won't be. You know, if there's an opportunity, timing, you know, timing chooses you. You don't always get to choose your timing. And so if there's a moment in time it makes sense to come back and the timing works on the family side, then I will.
Well, I think the larger question, so appreciate you sharing, I think it is about how do we make sure that people with integrity see themselves in this in a way where they could maintain that integrity?
Yeah.
And then along with it is how do you make sure that people with integrity can do it in a way where they hold on to that. If I think about like what I want to walk away from this with, I want to make sure, as I'm sure you've heard from other folks, you walk away with it feeling like you stayed true to yourself.
Yeah.
And I guess it's in our parliament's best interest or our democracy's best interest to have it set up in a way where people like yourself choose to stay for as long as possible.
Or as long as they still have the fire to
right.
to cause trouble.
Yeah,
which
agreed.
I still do. There are lots of different ways to make a difference. And I will miss it a great, great deal. It's been, I love it for many different reasons. I just got to ask questions of PHAC officials at the Canada-China Committee, which, you know, I joked with the team no one's really paying attention to. And then, of course, you know, it's covered in a number of national papers. But, you know, you get to ask the people who are responsible for the big decisions of the day, tough questions. I mean, that's the job. And yeah, you could easily read the softball questions that get sent as suggestions and, you know, you don't have to. You can ask whatever you like. You would have a lot of fun being on committees in that way too.
Well, one of the things I get to enjoy is because, as you know, Greens aren't formally appointed on any committee. I get to jump between the ones where there is an interest. Mm. So when the CEO of Metrolinx is showing up at transportation, yeah, I make sure I'm there that day and find a friend who's willing to share some time and or put forward amendments, which Greens can do in any committee. But certainly something I've learned a little bit about, which is the ways that larger parties have created various incentives for themselves. Committees are one example, right?
Yeah, and committees were even someone from Hansard had said, you know, things were very different even in the Harper days. Like it was so controlled. And there's still control exerted, but I can tell you, I showed nobody the questions I was asking at the Canada-China meeting of PHAC and the Deputy Minister of Health. I asked whatever I wanted. I had two rounds. Like, you know, it's not as, again, it's about carving out space, though. You got to carve out space for yourself, and so they know where you're coming from, and you stand your ground. Okay, so last two questions. Yeah. I think I already know the answer to the first one because you had mentioned it was one of the reasons you got into politics, but the single worst decision of the federal Liberal government.
I thought they were looking to find common ground. No, for me, Nate, like it would be on electoral reform. And it's not just for the lack of moving away from first past the post, but it's the extent to which it eroded trust in our democracy. Because it was such a signature commitment, you know, the PM promised it 1,800 times.
Was it actually 1,800 times?
It was 1,800, yeah.
Holy shit.
Fair vote.
That's a lot of times.
It was the mobilization around that, the way that lead now...
Is there a clip on YouTube where I can watch every 1,800, like every single... There should. How the NDP hasn't run that ad, I don't know.
It's painful.
But okay, so I would agree with you. I lived through that. The single best thing that the federal Liberal government's done. This is where we bring it back, you know?
Yeah, you know, getting...
Not all at once.
Appointing someone... I think what I've seen time and again is the Prime Minister has appointed people to cabinet who have genuine lived experience and passion for that work. My only hesitation in not coming right out with that is that I've been disappointed because some of those people have been shuffled out. And so I wanted to give you a fulsome answer that didn't have an asterisk with it, and I didn't quite
like
get there.
Like a true opposition member, it's
honest
at least. Nice. It's like a backhanded compliment. Okay, and we've got a year plus left to this parliament. You are running again, and other than the disability benefit, which, you know, there will be another round of advocacy into, you know, the next budget or the Fez. But to close this out, what are you working on next?
On climate, we can't lose sight of, as Stephen Guilbeault said on the podcast a few weeks back, the clean electricity regulations need to be strengthened significantly. We can't have new natural gas put back on the grid. The quality of the cap. The quality of the climate work that's being done and pushing for the stringency, because we know that the oil and gas lobby is doing their thing. So I'm going to continue to push as hard as I can on climate. Subsidies are another example. I'm so tired about this word of effective versus ineffective fossil fuel subsidies. So on climate, and the other we haven't talked about that it's going to be a huge focus for me over the next year and a half is on housing, and particularly on getting dollars flowing to building non-market quality, affordable housing. The co-op commitment as one example, we've got to get the federal government back to every year putting that money in place and making it more difficult, should there be another government in future, to ever step away from building that supply of non-market affordable housing.
Well, I appreciate the advocacy. I laughed. I saw people online start to attack the Prime Minister for going around provinces. And then you go to Pierre Poilievre's, it's very thin. It's like back of the napkin promises on housing. But one of them is effectively to go around provinces. And it's like the level of pretzel, partisans, I don't know if this happens in the Green Party, but the level of, contorting oneself into a pretzel to maintain commitment to the partisan cause is incredible at times. But you don't have that problem.
Well, but by design, I would put forward, and I think it's something I've seen it from you, Nate, and others in the Liberal Party, that it doesn't have to be that way.
It does not,
We have examples of people who have stayed true to themselves and made their way through it in different parties. Speaking for myself, it's something that means a lot to me for how I engage in this. And I think it's important for when we look at what we celebrate about an MP. Are we going to celebrate the fact that everyone voted the same way? Or are we going to celebrate the fact that we saw someone stand up for their community and put themselves on the line for that? I hope it's more of the latter.
Well, good way to end. Thank you, Mike, for your time. And I look forward to seeing you again next week.
Next week. You bet, Nate.
All right, take care.
Take care.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of Uncommons. As you can tell, Mike and I really get along. We kept going after we stopped recording. He thinks I should be a member of the Green Party. I, of course, think he should be an effective liberal and continue to help shape a progressive direction for the Liberal Party in this country. Regardless, I am glad that he is in Parliament and using his voice to do a whole lot of good. And as always, I should tell you to stop what you're doing right now and give us a 5-star review. You'll notice Mike Morris is a longtime listener, so I hope you're listening to a number of our episodes as well. If you have suggestions for guests going forward, whether they are partisan guests, nonpartisan guests, experts, everything in between, do send me a note, info@beynate.ca. And otherwise, until next time.